It's Helping Hand. Helping Hand is a weekly feature airing statewide on HPR1 stations Fridays as part of our afternoon drive broadcast of All Things Considered, and then appearing online at hawaiipublicradio.org, where all of our Helping Hand segments are archived. Helping Hand puts a spotlight on an organization, topic, or event that offers assistance to those with disabilities and the most vulnerable. I'm Dave Lawrence, and this week we are continuing 2 weeks of featuring two of the most vulnerable animals on Earth. Last week it was elephants, and this week it's rhinos, and in particular, the Sumatran rhino. All rhinos are under immense poaching threat due to rhino horn consumption by Asia-Pacific consumers, but the Sumatran rhino ranks as among the rarest and most vulnerable living creatures on Earth, and it's also facing critical habitat destruction. Only a few dozen are thought to exist, with 9 in captivity, 7 of them in Indonesia, and 2 in Malaysia. We've covered their plight for years, in particular the successes in Indonesia, but today we welcome the nonprofit Borneo Rhino Alliance. They are devoted to supporting the pair of Sumatran rhinos in Malaysia, which include Iman, whose recent health struggles we have covered. Dr. John Payne is the executive director of BORA, the Borneo Rhino Alliance, and our very special guest today from Malaysia. Aloha and welcome to HPR and Helping Hand, Dr. Payne.
Hi to you, Dave.
Thank you so much for taking some time for us. And first, explain how you got involved in this effort and provide a little insight into your professional background.
Well, I'll have to try and cut quite a long story short. I'm a biologist by background, and I'm 64 now. And my lifelong passion from childhood was in wildlife conservation. And it turned out that I ended up in Malaysia, specifically in the Bornean part on the equatorial island of Borneo in 1979 with a non-governmental organization called WWF, World Wildlife Fund. And even at that time, this Sumatran rhino was the most endangered species, not only in Malaysia, but regionally in Southeast Asia. So I've always had a particular interest, more than an interest, a passion for this highly endangered species for sort of 40 years or so now.
And before we get into the organization itself and your role in trying to help these animals, the particular vulnerabilities of the Sumatran rhino in terms of its rarity and the threats it faces, if you could just sum that up for an audience that's curious, that maybe doesn't know as much about it as you and I, but in a way of trying to raise awareness for these particular animals that are in your custody.
Actually, Dave, that's a good opportunity for me, and I think I'm going to sort of give a few insights rather than a direct reply. So number one, the Sumatran rhino, people think of rhinos, they think of the same sort of design of animal, and they are roughly, but the difference between the Sumatran rhino and African rhinos is as different, say, as the difference between the orangutan and chimpanzee. So they're both apes, but you wouldn't expect them to be counted as the same thing. So what I'm saying is the Sumatran rhino is a bit special. It's a different evolutionary line from way back. And in fact, the endangered status of the Sumatran rhino goes way back, way far, far further back in time than the African rhinos because of several reasons. And I think two I want to highlight, and this is getting really big picture. One is, one of the things about the end of the Pleistocene era, about 20,000 years ago in our modern era, is that sea levels rose by about 100 meters. We think it's a modern phenomenon, but in fact, rising sea levels are a very ancient thing, to the extent that what used to be a lot of the Sumatran rhino's habitat in Southeast Asia was drowned out naturally by rising sea levels from about 20,000 years ago to 8,000 years ago. So a lot of their prime habitat, if you look back, was actually drowned out anyway, leaving them in probably what for this species is rather marginal tropical rainforest habitat. Then, of course, one of the earlier civilizations was China, and some bright man whose identity I'm sure we'll never know now, probably something like about 1,500 years ago, someone got into their head the idea that powdered rhino horn is a useful ingredient in traditional medicine. And in fact, that belief started 1,000 plus years ago and right up to today. And the belief was never as an aphrodisiac. The belief was that rhino horn is a cooling ingredient. So in Chinese medicine, you get a number of ingredients put together, and the horn was the cooling bit. So you can imagine over 1,000 years plus, the pressure on one species from the demand from China was enormous. It's not a recent phenomenon. It's been going on for a millennium or so. So what I'm getting towards is that the numbers of the Sumatran rhino were very much reduced, even 1,000 years or so. They were very, very much reduced from the natural sort of baseline. So if we sort of fast forward to the 20th century, then the situation was the species was very, very unnaturally rare anyway. But then we have a sort of a phenomenon coming into play that the Sumatran rhino is sort of mixed up with the Indian rhino and the African rhino. And the mantra is that the species Sumatran rhino is threatened by habitat loss and poaching. And actually the problem has been for many decades that the species hasn't been breeding enough. There haven't been enough births because of that depressed population. Numbers very, very low, scattered. There weren't enough births to replace deaths. And I think this has been a major constraint to saving this species right up to date, because the assumption is habitat and poaching loss, and nowadays people blame oil palm plantations, was the problem. But in fact, what human beings should have done decades ago is realize that the species is threatened by not enough babies being born and derive some sort of program to get together between countries, between provinces, to boost the number of births. So that was rather long, but I think it gives you the context of what I and my colleagues are trying to do today.
Yeah, absolutely. It completely does. But part of that impact of man, when you say that they're not making enough births, isn't part of that because the populations are cut off from each other? And I guess what you're saying is they're cut off from each other more because of this apocalyptic sea rise that occurred a long time ago and less because of human development, if I'm reading into what you're saying.
Well, just to summarize, I mean, in addition to what I just said, yeah, I mean, the upshot was that individual rhinos have been separated for a long time, and I don't really attribute that to recent deforestation particularly. I mean, going back to my own experience, which of course is just an anecdote, but nearly 40 years ago in Sabah, northern Borneo, where I live, there were vast areas of forest with no rhinos in, because they'd already been poached out through that trade for a long time. So fragmented populations is an issue, but in the bigger context, it's not a recent phenomenon.
I got it. And I've read some of that recently, too, about that discovery that it goes a long, long way back with this issue. And you pointed out another thing which is very important, because part of it is a long way back. There were already Chinese settlers in that area involved in killing the rhinos and making the deals with, like, exchanging China ware for the rhino horn and stuff like that that people can learn about when they go to your website. You got us right to where we need to be in the phenomenon of these animals. There was a discovery of a male Sumatran rhino that's now in your custody, and I assume that's what led to the creation of the nonprofit, the Borneo Rhino Alliance, that you're from. I guess that's the next part of the story, yeah?
Yeah, I guess. Can be, yeah. So if I might comment on that. You know, all of our life is a combination, I guess, of luck and purposeful activities. So, as I mentioned, I was in World Wildlife Fund for many years. And in 2008, one rhino, which turned out subsequently, we didn't know at the time, to be the last male rhino alive in Malaysia. So this male rhino, Tam, turned up and kept walking around in an oil palm plantation. So, now, I don't know if you know, but the oil palm plantation is the biggest human land use in Malaysia, as it were. Apart from forest, oil palm takes up a lot of the land because it's so profitable. So this rhino kept coming out into oil palm, and quite clearly, as you'll know with that background, right, it's a matter of time before someone shot him or trapped him or poisoned him for the horn. So the decision was made, not by me, by the government of Sabah, to catch that rhino. Problem then was what exactly to do. You've got the rhino, one male rhino, what on earth to do with it? So the upshot was I left WWF Malaysia and with a few colleagues, local colleagues, revitalized an old non-governmental organization that had been monitoring rhinos for many years. So revitalized that old institution and rebranded it as Borneo Rhino Alliance, which we thought was a nice name, an alliance between government and passionate people, and set that up as a sort of mechanism to look after Tam. And then, and flowing from that, the idea was to, knowing that the species is very, very, very rare, if you leave them in the wild, they're just going to die. Whether they're poached or not, it didn't matter. They're going to die without breeding. So our idea in Borneo Rhino Alliance in 2009 was to set up a program to catch all the remaining wild rhinos in Sabah, Malaysia, to form a captive breeding program, which we did, and we were financed by a remarkable Malaysian foundation called the Sime Darby Foundation, as it turned out, for 7 years, who gave us funding, and equally importantly, the policy support. In wildlife conservation, the days of sort of doing things that you like to do 50, 100 years ago don't exist anymore. Everything is done under the supervision and agreement of government. So fortunately, the government of Sabah level and the federal government of Malaysia have been very supportive policy-wise and supported this idea of captive breeding. So we took it from there, and that sort of thinking goes out right up to today.
And so the organization's funding currently comes from, I'm imagining, a variety of sources, some donations, but then some government funding there?
Yeah, in fact, it's very much the government. I mean, governments often get a lot of stick for doing the wrong thing, but yeah, we get really important donations from private individuals on an ad hoc basis, but essentially at least 95% of our funding the last year has been from the government of Malaysia, which contracts my NGO, Borneo Rhino Alliance, to do this work for them. Quite remarkable, I think.
It is, and that's why I wanted you on the air in hopes of trying to raise some more donations, because one look at either of the two rhinos in your custody, and it's pretty hard not to fall in love with them. The day-to-day responsibilities of the Borneo Rhino Alliance and how many staff that you have there on site with the rhinos. Tell us a little bit about that.
We have a total staff of 15, of which 12 live on site with the rhinos. I live in the capital, I'm the boss, so I have to do the organizing, and we have a couple of admin staff, basically. And any institution is the admin and the finance people. But the staff on site looking after the rhinos are 12, and the structure, they're led by a very remarkable Malaysian man called Dr. Zainal Zahari Zainuddin, ZZZ, who is Malaysia's most experienced wildlife veterinarian. He worked in the federal government for many, many years, and he joined us in 2010. So the leadership and the veterinary care is led by Dr. Zainal. And the other staff are basically all young men. I have one young lady, but essentially young men from rural villages, mostly early school leavers, who are sort of reasonably happy living in remote areas and doing the sort of hard physical labor that men used to do a long time ago.
And these animals, I got to assume, kind of like the ones at the Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary in Indonesia, are under extraordinary protection too, right? They're safe. No one's going to get to them.
Interesting point. From our perspective in Sabah, they're safe. We have at least one person living within 50 meters of both rhinos 24/7. If you look at the African context, they would have been poached a long time ago, which is an interesting insight how different regions and different nations view security. So we look after them. I think it's largely the Malaysian and, for that matter, Indonesian, in a similar setting in Indonesia. I guess current culture, prevailing conditions, prevailing ways that people poach wildlife are different from region to region of the world.
Well, it's a good thing that they're safe. And I know at the SRS, because we've interviewed folks connected to that, they have those RPUs, I guess, the Rhino Protection Unit, which looks like a pretty fierce group of individuals to keep their safe. Looking at that facility, the Taban Wildlife Reserve, and again, we're talking with Dr. John Payne, Executive Director of the Borneo Rhino Alliance. That facility, it had at maximum, at its peak, a total of 3 rhinos, correct? Including Puntung, who passed away last year?
Yeah, that's correct. We always envisaged there would be more, but the upshot was, more by luck than planning, it turned out that our work in Borneo Rhino Alliance has just hit the tipping point of extinction. So when we started looking in 2009 or so, it turned out there are only 3 or 4 rhinos left by that stage. So we planned for more, but we ended up with 3 in the last few years.
Right, and when you look at videos of the facility, it can bring a tinge of sadness, because when Dr. Payne says they plan for more, there are individual stalls for each rhino, their names are over each stall, including Puntung, who passed last year, so it's a bit sad when you look at the facility. So they were able to capture a total of 2 more females, Iman and Puntung, who passed away last year. And before we hear about Iman's condition, are you of the opinion there's not a single wild rhino left in Malaysia, or any other wild, or what? And what do you think about wild?
Yeah, Dave. No, on that point, I mean, I frequently get asked, or more than asked, prodded by people say there must be more rhinos. And my answer is no, there aren't. And I guess that it's a combination. I mean, philosophically, one can't be 100% sure, but I'm 99.9999% sure because, number one, I've been literally 30, 40 years ago, I spent a lot of my time in the forest looking for the animals.
Right.
And, you know, they're a rhino, right? They're the smallest rhino, but they're a rhino. They're a massive animal with unique three-toed footprints, weighs 600 kilos. They browse 50 kilos of twigs every day. If they're there, you can find them.
Right.
An interesting human phenomenon, when I I'm sounding like an old man, but when I talk to young people who say these rhinos are really difficult to find, and my comment is, no, they're very easy to find. The reason you can't find them is there aren't any.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's that sort of interesting human perception on things.
Right. Now, that makes sense how you described it in a lot of sense, actually. And so we have heard a lot about your organization recently on All Things Considered, as I've been reporting since mid-December on Iman, who is one of only two rhinos there, the male rhino Tam, the female rhino Iman, and she made news because of health issues. Explain a little bit about her history and her health issues, including how she's doing right now.
All right. So this rhino Iman, female, we think she's in her late teens, which is sort of, you know, approaching, I don't know, not, I mean, this is a funny thing, but you can sort of say she's sort of maybe late 30s in human terms. So she's still fertile, but the time, the years are drawing in. Anyway, so we caught her deliberately in March 2014. And it turned out, initially we thought she was pregnant from her brother's sort of nervous behavior, and because by ultrasound examination we saw that there was something, a mass in her uterus. And then there was bleeding coming up from the uterus. And then we thought, well, goodness, we have a disaster. We've captured her, but the stress is going to lead to an aborted fetus, maybe. But it turned out within a couple of weeks we knew, and we had real expert advice from something called the Institute for Zoo and Wildlife Research in Berlin, Germany. The mass is actually an enormous mass of what in human terms are called fibroids, or technically leiomyoma tumors, which are not malignant, but tumors that grow up from the smooth muscle lining the uterus and grow up eventually to fill the whole uterus. So that is her health condition. She doesn't have malignant cancer, but her uterus is filled with tumors, which are living and still growing to this day. And what happens when she has a sudden movement, I mean, she slips on a slippery slope or is startled by some sound and she jerks her body. This is the risky time when tumors have little arteries going in, feeding in blood and oxygen. So every so often that bleeding starts when she gets shocked physically or through a sound. And this is the high-risk time. So whereas we can manage her general condition by basically reducing stress, giving her an excellent diet, monitoring her estrus cycle and so on, but there's two implications. So one I should say is that there's always a risk that the bleeding will start. And then the problem is, how on earth do you stop that bleeding before it becomes a flow that's impossible to stop? And the other, which I should mention, is really significant, is that even though she's cycling, she has an estrus cycle like any mammal and produces a small number of eggs every month, she cannot bear a pregnancy because the uterus is full of these tumors, so an embryo cannot implant inside her uterus. Final point, the remarkable work of Dr. Zainal, who I mentioned earlier. Actually, this is the third, since her capture in 2014, this is the third episode of severe bleeding that happened in the last, let's say, 7 or 8 weeks now, since December 2017. And through a combination of absolutely enormous care, I mean, a lot of the care, I'd say, is literally emotional. The fact that this rhino Iman knows that there's people actually at her side helping her over weeks, 24 hours a day through the night. I know, whether it's raining or dark or whatever, it doesn't matter. Plus vitamin K, things that staunch blood flow, things that artificial blood, as it were, that's put in by a tube into her ear, antibiotics in case infection is a problem. All those things on three occasions now have saved her life. So as of now, she's stabilized, and we're very, very happy. But that risk is always going to be there of a recurrence.
From what you said, I've got to believe that the sense of responsibility for such a rare, vulnerable animal must just at times become overwhelming for the staff, because as you say, it becomes a deep emotional connection, I imagine.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I guess, you know, as young men, they tend not to express their emotions clearly, but that's certainly the case, inevitably, right? Living and where your job, whatever the origin, whether you came in, some of them came in because they were jobless, some came in because they like wildlife, but whatever the job, that emotional connection does build up, of course, over the months and years.
And so she's accompanied by someone 24 hours a day. They're right there next to her, basically keeping an eye on her at this point.
Okay, when she's very sick, there's literally two people at her side all the time. When she's stable, like now, and you know, most of the time she's stabilized. But even then, there's two staff who would, of course, they have to sleep. They take turns. But they're, even if they don't look at her or see her physically, they're within at most about 50 meters of the rhinos at any one time, 24/7.
It's incredible. And it's a very, very humbling thing. She's still restricted to her night quarters, or can she go out into the outdoor area?
As of now, as about a week ago, we've done a modified outdoor area. And it's really tiny, and it's the size of, perhaps 12 by 10 meters, that sort of size. So it's the key thing is that we reduce the general stress of her living in a night stall, which, as you might imagine, is basically, you know, whether you like it or not, that's a lot of cement and iron bars in it. That's how it is. But to reduce that stress, so she has tree cover and there's mud under her feet. But more specifically, I should also mention that this particular species of rhino, they have to wallow in mud every day. I mean, obviously they don't, because Iman was in intensive care where she got a human-given mud bath every day, washed off and mud applied to her skin. But this rhino has evolved probably over millions of years. So they make their own wallow. They kick up, knock with their horn and their feet, holes, usually on a slightly sloping hillside. The rain can sort of flow in and get trapped. We're in an equatorial zone, right? So rainfall is like 3 or 4 meters a year.
Wow.
So every day they wallow in this mud, and it performs several roles. I mean, number one, I think as a biologist, the major one is to keep cool. You know, they're a big bodied animal in humid, high temperatures. So the way they keep cool is in mud, which releases the heat. Secondly, the mud really keeps their skin in good condition, and it keeps away biting insects. It keeps the skin subtle. Mud looks horrible, but it's actually a very, very healthy thing, kale and clay. And the other thing is, another thing I should just add, which contributed to their downfall, is that's when they go to sleep. So in the hot part of the day, from about 9 in the morning to 3:30 in the afternoon, they sleep and doze in the mud wallow. So they cool off in the hot part of the day, and that's when they sleep. Naturally, they're actually quite active and off, on and off through the night. That's when they go around in the cool time of day browsing. So as you can imagine, historically, that made this particular rhino such an easy species to poach. You never needed guns or traps. You can imagine 1,000 years ago, men just with spears would creep up on the wallow and spear the rhino. And that actually is a very major factor why the population declined worse, say, than tigers or elephants or other wildlife in Southeast Asia.
That does make them a really easy target with that sort of behavior pattern. Not to mention, they just seem like a real docile kind of tame animal, at least from what we understood about Harapan, whose handlers we got to talk to a few times and heard a lot about the kind of demeanor he had and other Sumatran rhinos that they had dealt with. Well, there has been one, really, besides the good news which you've just shared, which I'm going to take as good news that she has stabilized. The other good news story that has been almost at the same time that Iman has been making worldwide news, a story about Indonesian officials signaling that a collaboration could be in the works to share resources for an in vitro fertilization project. Talk about what that would mean and where things stand on that.
Okay. The first thing I should say is this is not really a new proposal. The idea of having an Indonesian-Malaysia collaboration actually started in the 1980s and got underway in 2013. And if you think about it, it's entirely rational. The modern nation-state concept that we have nowadays is really quite a relatively recent human phenomenon. So, you know, the where Indonesia is and where Malaysia is and Brunei and Singapore are now are purely human things generated over the last no more than 200 years or so. So when you get a species like the Sumatra rhino, which is very, very critically endangered, you cannot possibly isolate things by country or even by state or province. You really need one program where everyone from the national governmental level to the lower levels, the civil service, the technicians, the vets, are all working under one program. So as I say it now, it might seem blindingly obvious to you and me and everyone who's listening, but sad to say it's not blindingly obvious to many people, and not their fault, that's how they live. So the imperative to have a formal Indonesia-Malaysia agreement has been around for a long time. In an, as always, once you try to get agreements between nations, all sorts of issues come in, and one issue tends to get linked to another one. That's I mean, frankly, the reason why after 5 years now or so of trying to get a formal agreement between the two nations has been the case is that the rhino then gets linked, you know, to politics, sports, human issues, all that sort of thing.
Right.
And the rhino is always like number 10 or 20 or 30 on the list of bilateral discussions. So that gives you the context. So it's amazing that one government civil servant, not a politician, is quite unusual that a civil servant will come out and say, well, we think the agreement is on the way. So that's a major signal for us. I think, I mean, personally, I'd say it's great, but the big but is that do it now. The sooner the better, because frankly, to get things moving, all we need is frozen semen from either Harapan or Andalas in Indonesia. Get experts, of which we have one Indonesian and one Italian man sort of on standby, get them together to put the sperm from the semen and the egg together in a laboratory with a view to making embryos. Now, then you get people saying, well, it's never been done before. You know, well, you know, in 1975, they would have said the same thing about human beings. It's not impossible, but now we have millions of human beings in the world done by what they used to call rather nastily test tube babies, but right. Where the embryo has been made in the lab and then is implanted back into the mother. So this is what we want to do with the Sumatran rhino. Sad to say, the way the human world is set up nowadays, that needs formal national bilateral agreements before that can proceed.
And so we're just waiting on more than just a civil servant, as you put it, making such a positive statement, where you guys are waiting for some sort of more formal nod that long worked out agreement is beginning to come to terms.
We're waiting for that, but most, I mean, literally, we're always on standby, right? We have our WhatsApp on, and we have a small portable liquid nitrogen container. We have everything on standby. So it's essentially up to a bureaucrat somewhere to sign a certain letter and say, okay, go ahead now. That's what we're waiting for.
And to do it, as I've read, the semen and the egg would be mixed to create the embryo. It would be, as you put it, it would be ideally then carried into one of the female rhinos that's in Indonesia. Where would all the process take place?
As always, the devil is in the detail. I think our view in Malaysia is it doesn't really matter. There's several things. One is it doesn't matter. It would actually be logistically the easiest way is because Iman is the producer of the eggs, and eggs are more precious, more sensitive, more difficult to handle once they're out of the female, to do the in vitro fertilization in a lab in Malaysia. That's logistically easier. And this is not new. You can freeze semen, and in a normal drop of semen, there's millions of sperm. So you can freeze that for years, for decades, in liquid nitrogen and move it around much more easily. So rationally, the way is, as I mentioned earlier, to get frozen semen, bring it to Malaysia, to a lab in Malaysia, and have it done by an in vitro specialist.
Okay. So it's basically, we're hopeful that there will be some sort of official contact. Like you said, that letter has to get sent, or however you put it, which is a good way of describing the frustration as you wait for some sort of bureaucratic decision. In the question of Iman, despite her condition, she's still producing eggs, and do you have a supply of them stored?
Well, the answer is no. Okay, so as I said, the devil is in the detail. Actually, let me go back a bit. One thing I neglected to say, firstly, it's only literally 2 years ago that the first rhino embryo was produced in vitro, and that was done with white rhinos in an attempt to save what's called the northern white rhino in Central Africa. So the work was done by an Italian professor called Cesare Galli, who successfully did in vitro fertilization for white rhino. And the stories I heard 5 years ago is that, oh, it won't work, it's impossible, is now possible. So with rhinos, and we have a man who knows how to do it. So that's number one. Secondly, what I also didn't mention just now is I don't know why, but it turns out if you have an embryo, in other words, and it's just a few cells, right? It's not like a massive thing. It's a few cells where the sperm and egg are fused and they start dividing. At that stage, for some reason, the little tiny embryo is much more robust than an egg. So you can, and it's known in humans as well, you can freeze in liquid nitrogen, and that's crucial, it's minus 90 degrees. You can freeze in liquid nitrogen, and it instantly doesn't kill, but shuts down everything. So you can thaw it out later and get the embryo back. So the embryos are much more robust than eggs, which leads on to the third point, and your point is that, so Iman, since her capture in 2014, we have harvested about 18 eggs in total. It sounds tiny, it really is tiny. We would like to harvest a lot more. However, to take the eggs out of Iman is actually technically clearly understood, but needs a lot of skill and practice. So we have a particular German team from Berlin under the leadership of Professor Thomas Hildebrand, who comes on average twice a year, prearranged time, and we put Iman under general anesthesia because the procedure is invasive, and eggs are taken out of her. So what has happened is every time eggs are taken out, they go to a lab either in Malaysia over the last 4 years or in Europe under Professor Cesari. If in Malaysia, we have an Indonesian expert called Professor Arif Budiono, who's an expert who makes human babies as well. And he'll come and do the in vitro technique for us. So it's either in Europe or Malaysia. And as I mentioned, because eggs tend to be sensitive, it's actually best if you have an egg coming out of a mammal body, it actually makes sense to fertilize them as soon as possible. Mm. If you freeze eggs, there's a high chance that the egg will rupture when you thaw it and it's not viable anymore.
Man, you guys have some serious technical details to accomplish this thing. And it's really, it puts a lot of explanation on what is going on behind the scenes with this. And when it comes to people who are concerned, who would love to help out to support your organization, whether it's through donations to help you to be able to finance some of these delicate medical procedures that are hopefully coming up, whether it's volunteering by spreading the word about the organization, whether it's contacting legislators to try to prod them or urge them to make haste to do this as rapidly as possible. When it comes to the large listening audience that we've got in Afternoon Drive right now, please lay out anything and everything that you think people can do to try to help these animals and help your organization.
Thanks, Dave, for that opportunity. I'm going to have to be really mercenary and say, actually, the only way to help us now is financially through donations. But before I add a little bit more on that, I need to give you the background. Actually, this opportunity is great, but over the last few years, you know, because of the death of Puntong last year and various things, the capture of Iman in 2014, we in Sabra have built up quite a good network. So say, for example, in terms of veterinary help, Dr. Zainal is really the expert, but if a really critical decision needs to be made, so for example, you know, 6 weeks ago, should there be surgery inside the uterus? And the consensus globally was no, it's too risky. And things like that. So the veterinary care we've got pretty well. Advocacy for government, Malaysia not necessary. They're all on board. Indonesia, I think, frankly, what was necessary to have some public lobbying a year or two back. But now the message is there, as you've alluded to earlier in our conversation. So it's a matter of time before Indonesia collaborates in the way I think that we'd like them to. In terms of, you know, whatever legal help that we have people helping us with that. Frankly, everything is really set up quite nicely as a big scale system. And it really is the case that financing our role in Bora to keep the rhinos alive. And I just as an aside, I'd say my hope that I've never voiced publicly before is that Indonesia would be interested to build on the experience of Bora, which is a bit different from the people who run the SRS. So, for example, one of the skills of Bora has been the last 8 years by necessity is how to catch and translocate rhinos out of remote tropical rainforests. We know how to do that now, for example. So anyway, to summarize, I think we have a good system in place. And really, donations to keep us going is really the only critical need we have now. I'm just going to mention now that if you Google or look online, our organization is Borneo Rhino Alliance, and we have a website which will tell you more about us.
Yeah. Oh, we always end the segment with a list of all your contact stuff, and certainly that'll be part of your online plug as well for this.
Yep.
So let me give the contact information. It's BorneoRhinoAlliance.org. And as Dr. Payne has said, donations would help them with the day-to-day maintenance of these animals, which they are tasked with doing, and would help them with their upcoming and very hopeful chance for breeding of these animals. You can send them an email if you have a specific question or concern, or you want to learn more about the organization or have some thought about a way you could help them. Bora@BorneoRhinoAlliance.org, and that's BORA@BorneoRhinoAlliance.org. You can look for Bora, Borneo Rhino Alliance, on Facebook as well. You can get all the contact information, the full-length interview, the radio feature, and all of our other previous Helping Hand guests archived online at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Before we wrap it up, anything else that you think is important to share, Dr. Payne, about this remarkable mission that you're on with these very special creatures that comes to mind?
Thanks for the opportunity, too. I guess there's two things. I mean, one is just an add-on that, you know, when people give donations and they might be quite small, we still want them. And what I like to say is that basically our staff costs are covered by government. And basically a lot of the sort of basic running costs are by government. We do need extras, all those little things, right? I mean, it can be from buying supplements. We don't have a government budget to buy all those supplements, vitamins, medication we need. If we get Professor Arif Budiono over from Indonesia to help us, we don't have a budget for that. So there is a need for that top-up supplementary funding from what we get from government, just to make that clear. I think the other one is that my life with this rhino has been an interesting story in that it reveals a sort of bigger picture. And the reality is that, you know, there's 7 billion human beings, the number is going to increase a lot. Our use of resources is going to go up. And whereas the last 100 years or so, the sort of mantra has been, you know, national parks, wildlife reserves, protected areas to save wildlife. Those are all really needed and a real baseline. But I think where wildlife conservation is, in a sense, is going to have to go back to what it was maybe 50, 100 years ago. You know, the American bison, European bison, were saved from extinction by a small group of passionate people, often landowners or zoo people and so on. So I think, to me, we shouldn't lull ourselves into a sense of security that protected areas of habitat and stopping poaching and save endangered species. There needs to be a lot more creative thinking. What we're doing is one way, maybe producing embryos in the laboratory. Another way may be to get big landowners. For example, in the oil palm industry, which is, as I mentioned earlier, the biggest landowner in this region, they need to play a much bigger role in allowing wildlife to live in the plantations. So in summary, I'd say this is the rhino case, to me, is an interesting prompt to think how we collectively should think about conserving large, rare, wild animal species in the longer term.
We've been really privileged today to have Dr. John Payne, Executive Director of BORA, the Borneo Rhino Alliance, as our very special guest on the line from Malaysia and looking after among the very rarest living creatures anywhere on this planet that we all share. Huge thrill to get to talk to you and grateful to try to extend the reach of what you're doing, and I'm hopeful that folks out here who heard it will support the organization, but on behalf of both of those rhinos that you're looking after and the future success that's coming, thank you so much for doing what you're doing, Dr. Payne.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to say what I always like to say in public. Thanks, Dave. Many thanks.
Take care.
Okay, and you, Dave. Yeah.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.